I'm Kathy Forstey, music director at KC Cafe Radio. Today we are chatting with narrative engineer Robert Morgan Fisher. Robert's latest CD, Notes for a Novel, has already received praise and accolades from American Songwriter Magazine and Roots Music Report, which gives it 5 stars. Robert describes himself as an artist who has 1 foot firmly in fiction and the other foot in screenwriting and his heart in music. Robert, thanks so much for joining us today on KC Cafe Radio.
Thanks, Kathy. It's great to be here.
Where are you at? Where do you live and where do you make your home?
I live in Los Angeles. I live in Woodland Hills, up in the hills south of the boulevard. You know, we've got a modest little ranch house, and I've lived here for about 12 years or so, and got a wife and 2 kids, and one boy, 13, one almost 11.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You were actually born in Austin, Texas. How did you make your way out to L.A.?
Well, I was, it's so funny. When you tell people where you were born in Austin, they just assume, well, he was born there, and then he went directly to L.A. My dad was a Navy aviator, you know, so we lived everywhere 10 times. I lived all over the place, and as a result, I'm kind of like Zelig, you know. I'm a very good mimic. It comes from my Morgan side of the family. My grandmother, my dad's mother was a Morgan, and so it's that Irish ability to sort of imitate. And so when I've, you know, lived in the Northeast, you know, I would kind of talk like this, and you know, when I lived down south, I'd just be really automatically be like that. And then I do a lot of voice acting and stuff too, so it's, I'm able to just sort of have a straight announce it when I need it. But I'm good with imitating. And you can, on my record, you know, I do some impersonations a little bit, sort of muted and on a couple of the songs like Jester King.
Mm-hmm. Tell people what Jester King is about and who you're imitating on that.
Well, Jester King, I wrote that in the wake of Katrina. And Jester King is about the mismanagement of that, and it's sort of on the record I say this is a fable that could never happen in real life. It's really about a jester who was the son of the old king, who's, you know, out of power now, but he uses his jester son, he gets his son a job as the jester, and through that subverts the new king, you know, and when they go back to the old toxic dysfunctional ways.
Mm-hmm.
Sound familiar?
Yeah. I think we can get who that's about.
That song was actually went number one on Neil Young's Living with War Songs of Our Time website.
Uh-huh.
I don't know how that site works. You know, you submit it and they accept it, and there's thousands of songs on it, and people click. You know, and they vote by clicking and listening to the song, and through various clicks and so forth, it made its way up to number one. And one other song that's on my new record, Will Buy a Flag, actually also went number one on that chart.
Yeah, it's a really cool chart. Is he still doing that? Is it still functioning?
Well, I would assume so. Yeah, no, I mean, I would think that if he had discontinued it, there would have been some noise about
it.
Yeah,
yeah. I have a friend who had a song on that chart too, and so I went and listened to his song quite a bit on there too. So it's really cool. Cool idea that he did. It's getting back to the political, you don't seem like you're too afraid to be political and in your music and maybe alienate some folks. Is that ever a concern of yours, or you just feel like, I'm going to speak my mind, and if you agree with me, good. If you don't, so what?
Yeah, but that's really the way it is. I'm not that partisan, you know. I have definite views about things. There's some ways that I'm real conservative, you know. I mean, I think that we should get our fiscal house in order, but I don't think it should be on the backs of the middle class, for example. My father was a warrior, but he was kind of he's still with us very much. I don't want to talk to him like he's gone. He's a great guy and really supportive of my music. In fact, we could do a whole show just about me and my dad. He is very, very progressive for a guy who, you know, did like 5 tours in Vietnam, you know, and rubbed shoulders with John McCain during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And, and he always told me, you know, stand up and be counted, you know. I remember when I was a senior in high school, you know, at Oak Harbor High School, they voted down the levy. We didn't have sports. And a lot of people fled, you know, to other high schools to try to get scholarships and go to college. And I kind of understand why they did that. But my dad said to me, he said, you know, when that kind of thing happens, you don't leave. You stay and you roll up your sleeves and you fight.
Mm-hmm.
although I'm not sure that those guys could have, you know, gained. And I left in the middle of my senior year because we got transferred to Dayton, Ohio, and which was a whole other experience.
Yeah, a working man's town. So how did you get started in music then, if you were traveling so much? And
well, in my house, my father and mother always held certain music in high esteem, and they had a high bar for it. I'll never forget the time that the first time we ever heard King of the Road by Roger Miller come on the radio. And it was like aliens had landed from Mars. I mean, there was so much excitement in the kitchen. Who is that guy? Who is that guy? And they bought the record, something we never did, you know, that little 45 on Smash Records, mm-hmm. right? Flip side was Attaboy Girl, right? And we wore it out. And I wasn't alive when I Walk the Line came out, but they told me it was the same thing when Johnny Cash, I Walk the Line came out. They were like, wow, you know. So my father would always explain to me, and he always made sure I had a guitar. And he would cultivate me and indoctrinate me on great songwriters. Surprisingly, I mean, like he would get like the latest Kris Kristofferson record or John Prine or Tom Waits or Leonard Cohen. And he would say, this is a great song because it's really between the lines. I mean, he wasn't a musician himself, but he just knows what he likes. And he thinks that my dad was a great believer in music as a tool of social change. Mm. And that you don't want to waste a song. And so that's why growing up in the 70s, 60s and late 60s and through the mid 70s was such an amazing time for music. Yeah. Top 40 radio was like, there were so many message songs out there and narrative songs. That's where my love of story songs first came around. And I got my hooks into Harry Chapin and Jim Croce and those guys. Mm-hmm.
So what did you do first? Did you write music first or did you write stories first? Because you're a really great literature writer as well.
Thank you. And I was always reading, you know, voraciously. My focus in the beginning, besides just learning every song I could, I'm a human jukebox. And I believe that you have to really know the form thoroughly. I have an amazing record collection. You have to really study it in order to write mm-hmm. it. And it's the same with fiction, too. I have a great book collection, too. My office is like my womb, my creative womb. But I, my focus was on my chops. I wanted to be Leo Kottke. At various times, I wanted to be various people. You know, I wanted to be John Denver. I wanted to be Jim Croce. I wanted to be, you know, all these. I wanted to be America. I wanted to be that group America. I thought those guys had the greatest job in the world to just be tour with three guys on acoustic guitars and do those songs. I thought that mm-hmm. was like the greatest. And, you know, so I was my first songwriting attempts were very tentative. And I remember one of my first songs, which my friends really liked, but I played for my dad. And he goes, you know, nobody wants to hear some song from an 18-year-old kid about a love affair, you know, right? He was kind of withering. And in a way, it kind of held me back, but not for long. By the time I was in my mid to late 20s, I was making serious attempts to write quality songs. And he eventually came around and really just really supported what I was doing as a songwriter. But he the bar was high, mm-hmm. you know, and I thank him for that. That was really great. But for me, there was a time in the 80s where I was like a nightclub DJ and fairly well paid, but playing just mostly a lot of crap. And was very discouraged. And during the day, prior to going to my gig, I would just practice scales. I wanted to marry the rich acoustic textures of Leo Kottke with the fast virtuosity, single string virtuosity of Al Di Meola. Mm-hmm. And to this day, I have pretty good technique, you mm-hmm. know, but it's not something I'm interested in. Technique is a means to an end. It's a tool in order to write more interesting songs. I actually got hooked up with Daryl Purpose. We wrote, you know, co-wrote a number of songs over four or five albums and continue. His latest album has a co-write that we did. One of the reasons we had such good chemistry is because he's a fantastic instrumentalist. Mm-hmm. And we saw that in each other. He too was a devotee of Leo Kottke, and a lot of the same influences I did. In fact, recently I met Ingrid Croce, Jim Croce's wife. She's got a biography of Jim called I Got a Name. Well, it's kind of an autobiography because it's her story too. And it's absolutely great. I really recommend it. And I got a chance to meet her. And when I did, she came right here to my neighborhood. It's incredible. When I heard that she was going to be around, I was like so excited. I had this old Jim Croce songbook that was exactly like one I had as a kid that Daryl had given me 20 years ago when he was cleaning out his garage, and I kept it.
Cool.
And I brought it down there and I had her sign it to him and then mailed it to him in Colorado. He was really surprised.
That's very cool. Yeah, I really think if Jim Croce would have lived, he would have been considered to want to be one of the songwriters like a James Taylor or something. I mean, he could have really done some more great things than what he had done up to that point.
He was on track, I think. He's already a legend. Right. I mean, you know, he'd already achieved it, you know, but and unfortunately a lot of the monetary reward was delayed in coming to his widow, Ingrid. But she eventually, I think, made out okay. She's got a great restaurant in San Diego called Croce's, and she's a real sweet lady. It would have been interesting to see what he would have done, how he would have handled disco, for instance.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
You know, maybe he, I don't know, who knows? There's no telling what he would have done. I mean, it's interesting. And so much of his amazing art was his guitar player, Maury Muehlheisen. Mm-hmm. I'm actually going to be performing at Croce's on January 10th in San Diego as part of a private party that's a tribute to Jim. And I'll be doing a set of Jim's songs with my producer, Chad Watson. He will be Maury Muehlheisen to my Jim Croce. Ingrid invited us down there to play.
Oh, that's exciting. So do you know what songs of his you're going to play yet?
I do.
But you don't want to let the cat out of the bag.
Well, I want to see if we can handle him, you know, because and Chad's a fantastic guitarist, you know, he's really good. If anybody could do more, in fact, all across all three of my albums, Chad has done lead work on those albums, and the references that I've given him, you know, have been like, I want this to sound like One Less Set of Footsteps, you know, or I want to sound like Operator, you know. Yeah, so, you know, who knows?
I remember seeing him on Midnight Special, and it was just him and his guitarist, and, you know, it was just amazing, you know, all the sound they produced and the harmonies, and, yeah.
One of the great things about Jim, he had so much. He was very, very much influenced by Gordon Lightfoot, who, for me, is without peer, you know. Thane Tierney, who did the Lightfoot box set, the definitive box set for Rhino years ago, is a friend of mine. And Thane's liner notes about Gordon really kind of sum it up. You know, nobody could sing like Gordon, could arrange like him, could finger pick, could play, could write songs. You know, he had it all. Mm-hmm. And Croce actually was, you know, very influenced by that. And one of the things that Jim Croce had that Gordon doesn't is that he was an amazing raconteur. Not that Gordon can't tell a story, but I mean, nobody could tell a story like Jim Croce, you know, and his between song patter and his stories. And this book that Ingrid Croce did is just full of that stuff. He would have these throwaway lines. The only other artist I can think of that just talks conversationally like a complete poet or raconteur, like this kind of, you know, storyteller is Tom Waits, you know.
Yeah.
So I love those guys.
Yeah. People who can meld their stories into the songs, you know, are just amazing. Yeah. So you started performing when you were in college?
I did. I performed in Austin at a few bars, you know. I was really, really green. There were people in the scene who were much more evolved than me, like Eric Taylor and Nancy Griffith and Robert O'Keefe and Lyle Lovett. I mean, those people were really eating, sleeping, and breathing songs and songwriting.
Were those your peers or did you?
Yeah, I ran into Eric and Nancy one night. It was great.
That's awesome.
You know, they were They were we jammed at Folkville Ice Cream, you know, one night when there was pouring rain. There was nobody in there but Weldon Brewer and myself and those two, and they were something else. Mm-hmm. And it really inspired me and humbled me. One part of my story is that I was a correspondent for MTV in the early 80s. Uh-huh. And, you know, I did, like I said, I've done some DJing, announcing and VJing, and I got a chance to do the first ever news story on VH1 on New Year's Day, 1985. Doug Herzog, my boss at MTV, called me up and said, "Hey, you know, why don't you cover Willie Nelson's New Year's Eve party, a press conference?" And so I did that, and we wound up getting full length interviews with Johnny Cash, Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, and Kris Kristofferson about a month before they became the Highwaymen. Wow. And I remember when I was interviewing Willie, I just to kind of break the ice and kind of, you know, put him at ease, I said, "Hey, you know, I'm from Austin. I used to perform at the Alamo Lounge and places like that." And he said, I was totally unprepared for this, but he said, "Oh, yeah." He says, "Do you have any songs that I should hear?" And I said, truthfully, to my credit, I said, "No, I didn't have any songs that were good enough, you know."
Yeah. So you got a degree in television, radio? Is that what you got a degree?
Yeah, radio, TV, and film. You know, I figured a concentration on radio, really. Mm-hmm. I was getting the degree and did a lot of creative writing courses at the University of Texas, too. But I was really young and immature and just, you know, really just not really finding my way. I've always been a late bloomer. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I was in my late 20s, early 30s where I just said, "Oh, you know, oh, yeah, I'm a writer, man. I've been writing this whole time and reading. You know, I'm a songwriter and I'm a fiction writer." And for years, I kept the two separate. And only in the last two or three years did I break down that Chinese wall and just really said, you know, okay, they go hand in hand. I'm a narrative engineer. That's what
I
am.
Yeah, I like that title.
And if you go to my website, robertmorganfisher.com. Uh-huh. It's a great website. Russ Paris designed it, and it really to my specifications.
Yeah, I love the look of it. There's a nice old roll top desk on the front, and you kind of click into the different areas of your career. And I was wondering if I clicked on this desk and I looked at the CDs that are sitting on the table, what CDs would those be on the desk there?
You know, I think on my iPhone, I can actually zoom in and look. I know for sure that I purposely, because Russ Paris took that photo, mm-hmm. right, of a lot of Ron Sarfati took the photo of the desk. And then Russ took the individual photos of all the little gewgaws and knickknacks and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I purposely chose CDs. Like, for sure, there'd be there's a Dave Carter CD in there, I believe. You know, I went in there and just, you know, Daryl Purpose CD, and, you know, I chose a lot of my favorite artists and really influential records, and I put them on there, but I can't remember what they were now.
No.
The books though are definitely influential, and they're very easy to read and kind of make out.
Yeah, I see, like a Jack Kerouac and,
you know, Stephen Milhauser, and, you know,
very cool. So how did you get from working in radio and television? You wrote scripts for different programs and
yeah. Well, the trajectory was I came out here and I did a lot of, you know, worked in some improv. You know, I studied with the Groundlings and I wound up being in an improv group for about 3 years. It was pretty, you know, acclaimed and forward thinking. Had some real famous people eventually, and you know that, you know, both cast members and guests, you know, like Danny Smith from Family Guy came through a few times, and Michael McDonald from Mad TV, you know, he was one of the cast got people. I was the weak link, but I learned a lot, and it was a lot of fun. Real broad characters, like long form improv. Mm-hmm. And then I wound up worked real hard and broke into writing radio comedy, which was didn't pay much. But eventually I got with a couple of different syndicates and wound up having a staff producer writer job there. Mm-hmm. Premier Radio Networks, which eventually got bought by Clear Channel.
Everybody's been bought by Clear Channel.
That's a whole other story. But and I wrote for a couple awful TV shows, got a little credit there and some money. And about this time in about the mid-90s, I really dove into a serious stab at fiction. I'd been reading and preparing for that and wrote my first novel and wound up winning a big prize. And then my second novel, 112, nothing's been published yet. It's very hard to break into serious fiction, mm-hmm. you know, as literature. And I have a book agent who is very determined not to get me not just published, but published well. She's on board. She understands what I'm about, that I'm a narrative engineer, and that that the short story is really my forte.
What kind of fiction is it?
I write, I'm a big devotee of Raymond Carver and T.C. Boyle and Rick Demarinis and Mary Gateskill, and just got the latest book by Alice Munro today. I write serious fiction like that. Mm-hmm. I want my stories to be accessible, and I am pretty, my tools of conceptual development are strong enough that I can kind of pick a theme and then write a whole collection around that. So I've got some, you know, various collections kind of sitting around, you know, and I get pretty academic about it. I'm very serious about it. But my goal is to get what they call a dead tree book, a book that you would sell in a brick and mortar store, mm-hmm. you know, and a companion CD of songs. I write companion songs to my short stories. That's my brand. Uh-huh. And if I can say so, I mean, there are fiction writers who dabble in music, and maybe they're in the rock bottom remainders, you know, or they've kind of tried to do that, and that's great. And then there are serious songwriters who have dabbled in fiction. My friend Mary Gaucher, you know, has written short stories, and Steve Earle. But I truly believe that I am a person who does both really well and uniquely. But right now I'm trying to get a book published, and I'm not ready to self-publish. That's punting.
Yeah. So which one of those do you enjoy doing the most, writing music or literature? Or?
Well, God, that's a great question, because I have three albums and they're all pretty consistent. Chad Watson produced all of them. And to see those songs on Reverb Nation and to see them sold on CD Baby, which is where you can get my records, I like my songs, and to complete them and to go out and perform them is great. But I have to tell you, when I finish a short story, I really feel like I've accomplished something, and I can pretty much write a song on demand. Whether it's a song I'll play live and you know, want to play for the 100th time is another question. Mm-hmm. But I don't, I know a lot of my songwriter friends that are really prolific, you know. They write a song a day, you know. You hear that sometimes, you know, this guy's so great. He's wrote a song every day for his whole mm-hmm. life, you know. And a lot of songs are really good, you know. But I am really loath, you know, to bring a song out in public on a record or in a performance if it's not something I'm going to be comfortable playing on a consistent basis.
Mm-hmm. So is songwriting for you more of a, I'm not sure how to phrase it, more of something that comes automatically, or do you sit and you ruminate about a song, or is it just flow out of you?
Both, actually. Anatomy 101 took years to write. I knew I wanted to write a updated Riddle song. You know, I gave my love a cherry that hath no stone, mm-hmm. you know. Which, by the way, I have sung that song in front of Stephen Bishop at the 30th anniversary class reunion of Animal House. I produced that reunion, that party, and I had a Belushi impersonator come out and take this guitar I was playing and smash it into a million pieces. It was really fun. Yeah, that took a long time. Other times, you know, like Greenhouse, I built myself a Greenhouse album, or Life in Music. I don't even remember writing them. I just all of a sudden they were there. It happened so fast. Kissinger is a song that's on my new record, 10-minute song about Henry
yeah,
Kissinger.
It's a great song, though.
As Tom Russell would say, another commercial smash. That song, I had all the lyrics, but I had all the verses but the last two. And it sat, and I didn't play it and was undone, you know, but I kind of had the pattern of it, and I worked on that lick, you know, that, let me see his finger. Like that, mm-hmm. you know, I had that lick where I could, I got it to where I could just do it and sing unconsciously do the hot lick. James Coberly Smith he's up in Idaho now, but he said, if you're going to do that song, you got to do that lick all the way through, and you got to be able to just do it in your sleep. And he was mm-hmm. right, you know. So I worked on that for years while I was still kind of figuring out how to end the song. And then the Iraq War happened, and I found out that Henry Kissinger had encouraged Dick Cheney and George Bush to pursue pursue that. And that was the last straw, yeah. You know, then it's just easy. Those last two verses, you know, because I don't think that that was, I admire the soldiers that went, and I have nothing but respect for them, but I think that we took our eye off the ball. So that's all I'll say about that.
I agree. I'm glad that you have the courage to write those kind of songs. I think it's important that we hear that message.
Thank you.
We're talking to Robert Morgan Fisher, whose new CD is called Notes for a Novel. And speaking of which, you were talking about songs that are companion songs for pieces of short stories you've written. One of the songs on the CD is called Don't You Want to Go to Mars? And yeah. That's got a companion short story. Can you tell me about how the short story works with that song?
I wrote a short story called Don't You Want to Go to Mars? And then I wrote the song. And that song was really about a African-American family who the wife is in Iraq and the husband is home with their boy who is a math genius. And the father really has set a long-term goal to have the boy be the first man on Mars. He's done the math. He knows if we're going to go, that his son is going to be the right exact age to do that. And certain things have to happen to make that happen. He's got to do really, really well in math, and he's got to fly jets. But all of that is sort of, whether that's going to happen or not is irrelevant. It's all kind of gone by the wayside now that their family's been torn apart, and the wife has been stop-lost, as I say in the song, to Haditha. So that is a companion song to that story.
Very good.
It's actually, tomorrow night, I'm actually going to be, that song, first of all, that song was one of the top six folk songs of the year from the Song of the Year competition. And it's been nominated as Folk Song of the Year for the Hollywood Music and Media Awards, which I don't know if anybody outside of Hollywood really kind of knows about this, but it's sort of like the Music Golden Globes in a way, you know. It's a real big deal. It's at the Henry Fonda Theater, and it's a star-studded thing with limos and a red carpet and stuff.
Very cool.
And, so I'm going to be showing up there and maybe getting that award.
Awesome. Are you going to be performing as well?
No, I'm not one of the slated performers. Which I'm kind of glad for, actually.
Yeah, you can enjoy the evening a little bit that way.
Exactly. I can enjoy the evening better, you know.
Let's talk about the artwork on the CD. I love the artwork on this CD. Who did that, and how did you get the idea for that?
That's a great story. There's an artist called Jet. Her name is Jet Jackson, not to be confused with the cartoon character. But Jet had her was Jet Jackson long before this other thing. And Jet, she is fantastic. And I first met her about 20 years ago. I went on an artist loft tour of downtown L.A. We won it from the public radio station here in town. And we met her. And her loft was incredible, and it was this floor to ceiling, like a 20-foot high ceiling, covered with her paintings. And they're really unusual, a lot like the ones, like the cover. She was sitting on a couch looking grand and elegant, and she was smoking a cigarette. Mm-hmm. And we said, how much for this Snow White? It was a parody of Snow White. And she goes, I'm sorry, that's $14,000. And I said, walking around money. And she laughed, and she ground out her cigarette, and she says, I like you guys. And she took my wife and I into this special room where she had like a thing. We wound up getting a painting of hers that it was framed, that hangs above her piano. We love it. And it's called City Night with Lovers. And I kept in touch with her. She is a fan of my music. She's has all three of my. She had my first two records, and I would touch base with her. And she's a major American artist now. She's in galleries all over the world. And very, very well known, and her paintings fetch a lot of money. They're very valuable. And there's a thing online where you can look her up, Jet Jackson Artist, and it'll take you. I forget what the website is. It's on the CD, actually. And there was a painting there, which I was familiar with, of hers called City Night and City Night Number 2. And City Night Number 2 is the one that's on the cover of the record. And I just knew that I had to have that painting. And I sent her an email, and she emailed me back 5 minutes later and said, this is meant to be. She goes, I am in North Carolina on an island, and one of my patrons is enabling me to just paint. And I check my email once a month. Wow. And I just checked right now, and your email came in 5 minutes ago. So yeah, absolutely you can use that painting.
Yeah, you know? It's a great cover. And even in this day and age of digital and stuff, I'm a big fan of the physical CD, and I like having something to hold in my hands while I'm listening to music. It's a great visual to look at while you're listening to your songs.
And I love seeing the thumbnail of it on Casey Cafe Radio.
Yeah.
Yeah. I go on there. It just looks great, you know. And like Mark Cote's album cover is great, mm-hmm. too.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, he's a great guy and very talented. His record's wonderful. Mm-hmm. But I really like that. I'm glad you like the album art. I've gotten a lot of good notices for
it. It's wonderful. Because a lot of people just throw away that thought anymore with the digital age and all this. But I mean, I'm a big fan of the album cover. So.
Yeah.
So you write solo, you write by yourself, but you do collaborate with Daryl Purpose, and you've also collaborated with Dr. Timothy Leary too. How did that happen?
Well, I actually, in the early 90s, I had I was transitioning to my life as a writer. I had a day job where I was a producer manager, a guy named Eric Gardner, and who I learned a lot from. And he's an interesting character. And he, is part of my job every day. About three times a day, I would talk to various people, and like from Paul Schaefer to Todd Rundgren, Brian Setzer, all kinds of people. And it was very educational. And one of those people was Timothy Leary. And Tim came to see me in an improv show, and was the whole show became about Tim. You know, the crowd went nuts. And we incorporated him into the show, and he would call me up and say, "Robert, come on over," you know, because I actually would pass by his house on my way from Los Feliz to Santa Monica, where I lived at the time, and he would have me stop by. He says, "Stop by, have some wine," you know, and it would always be a scene. There'd be these amazing paintings on the wall, and very cool people, just you know, kind of in and out, and Tim was just such a giving, enthusiastic guy, you know. He kind of had that sensibility that is like the best part of the Beats. We kind of forget, you know, that the cool thing about Kerouac and Ginsberg and all those guys and Neil Cassidy is that they were so positive, man, about things. Well, Jack not so much towards the end of his life, you know, but Timothy was just, everything was just a fantastic thing to celebrate. And, oh, this is the greatest thing. And he would sign his books to me, to my best friend in the whole world, a wonderful man. You know, just like, and so he, Byard Johnson, who's a great songwriter and a great author. And I'm glad to say he has recovered from some recent health problems, and he's going to be with us for a while. He produced an album with Russell Means music, the leader of the American Indian Movement, who passed on just 2 weeks ago. And he gave a copy to Tim as a gift. And Tim says, "Oh, I want to do this. Can we do this? Can we make a record?" And we said, "Sure, Tim." So, you know, myself and Byron and Simon Stokes, a guy who used to be on Elektra, we sat down at Tim's house and we just started writing songs. And we did a whole album. And in the middle of the album, writing the music, Tim found out he was terminally ill with cancer. Mm. And the album became a tome on embracing death, because Tim was of the opinion that this was the next big adventure for him. And he was very, very excited and optimistic about mm-hmm. it. And it was called Right to Fly. And it's around. You can get copies of it. They're on the internet, you know, right? King Biscuit distributed it for a while. I've seen, you know, maybe a couple of dollars in royalties through the years. I co-wrote a song called Seeing Eye Man with Tim on that, you know, about his dog who was totally blind, this golden retriever, and it would bump into trees and stuff, and we're like, "Tim, Bo's totally blind." He's like, "Oh yes, I'm his seeing eye man." And
that's awesome. You also work with Janice Ian. How did you get Janice Ian to work with you on your CD?
Yeah, wow, just really, really proud to have done that song with her. Chad Watson, my producer over three albums, is really an amazing, respected musician. He did 8 years on the road with Janice and is mentioned in her biography a couple times. Her biography is Society's Child. I really recommend it. It is great. You can get it on audio too. And he also did 10 years on the road with Charlie Rich. And he has never called in what Chad would call a fun ticket, a favor, you know, with Janice. But he felt "Don't You Want to Go to Mars" was the kind of song she could get excited about, maybe. Mm-hmm. And he called her up and he said, "I got a song that is about education, which is one of her big causes that she contributes a lot to. You know, there's a scholarship in her mother's name. And you ought to hear this song." And she goes, "Absolutely, I'll do it. And I'll do it for free. You just pay the studio cost and I'll do it."
Wow.
And that says a lot about her. She's a person of great integrity.
Yes.
And an amazing talent. And people, until you read her biography or autobiography, you're not going to really know just what a player she was in the scene from a young mm-hmm. age. She knew Hendrix and Janis Joplin and all these people. Bruce Springsteen. It's amazing. She has lived an amazing life and survived a lot of incredible hardship and toxic relationships. Mm-hmm. I really recommend her book. So yeah, Janis Ian, and she, you know, she did the harmonies on that.
Yeah, it's a great song. I really love that song.
Thank you.
Another one of my favorite songs on there is "Ought to Be a Highway," which you wrote with Daryl Purpose. How did you guys collaborate on that song?
Daryl and I wrote that about 12 years ago or something. There was a time when Daryl and I would get together a lot and just write songs for his next record, because we really had a great chemistry, and we, you know, the story song thing was our brand. And I said, I got an idea about a song about a guy who's riding out west and having to do it on a horse and in the 1800s. And he's like a lot of people did, and just wishing there was a highway. And I gave him a couple of lyrics and he said, "That one." That one, you know. So it was on his album, A Crooked Line. Very proud to say that one of the great honors of my life is that when that song first came out on A Crooked Line, the backing musicians were Tracy Grammer and Dave Carter. Mm. That's Dave Carter playing banjo. Now, I knew that because they were so great, I had to do my version of it. And we were recording it, and Chad, we had a pretty decent version, and John McEwen on banjo, and John York of the Byrds harmonizing with me on that. And it was like, it was sounding good, but it just needed something. And I said, "Chad, I got an idea." "Bear with me, okay?" And I said, and I told the engineer, Brad Swanson, I said, "I want you to make my vocals give me a lot of slapback, a total echo. I want to sound like Johnny Cash. And then I want you to process my voice on the third verse, like Winchester Cathedral."
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. Right. That's what I thought when I heard the song for the first time. I was like, "That's what that sounds like."
Yeah, right. You know. By the way, trivia question: Who did Winchester Cathedral? The new vaudeville band. Thank you. I told you I have a great record collection. So that's what we did, and I'm real proud of how it turned out. And it worked out great.
Notes for a Novel is your third CD. How would you compare the recording of this CD to your first CD, which you did in 96?
The first CD was done at Room 222 Studios with Larry Goetz, who was great. It was our first record. I brought Chad in. I say it was co-produced by Chad, as well as my second album co-produced. But I really, on this third album, I said, I got to say, Chad is the producer, okay? I may be paying for everything, but Chad is the producer. Mm-hmm. That's a really great question, and here's why. Because all three of my records are consistent. They're paced very similarly. They have a lot of common threads through them. So if you buy my entire discography, which I hope you'll do on CD Baby, you'll be happy. If you like one record, you'll like the other two. Every album has a song about a guitar. Every album starts out with an upbeat wake up number. Mm-hmm. My first song ever, my first album was Greasy Coffee Beans. And the second album was Get Up, Get Out of Bed. And the third one is Unimpressed. So there's certain things that I do, and then I I'll have like an up-tempo song, and I'll have a couple of ballads and so forth. So there's some consistency. As far as the first album goes, not a lot of star turns on that record. Byron Berline did fiddle on a couple of songs. He's about the biggest star that's on there. It still holds up, that album. Yeah. You know.
How long did it take to record that one, and how long did it take to record Notes for a Novel?
Another great question. I recorded a whole other album before I recorded Follow a Hunch, because of my I had that learning curve you had to go through. And it was called, I think it was called Tenor of the Times. And my vocal style on it was totally off. Not that I sang off key, but I was pushing too hard. And by the time we got down and we're almost ready to mix, I said, you know what? We're going to jettison about three or four of these songs. I've got some new stuff. It's a whole new album, whole new approach. This is what we're going to do. It cost a little bit more money, but I'm glad that we didn't settle. So that was the big lesson there.
And so how long did it take to record Notes for a Novel?
Notes for a Novel, about 6 months.
6 months.
6 months. Yeah. Actually about 5 months. I'm about a 5 month guy on an album. All three of my albums about 5 months, not counting the false start on the first one, where I was just really kind of finding my footing in the studio. Yeah. Second album, Built Myself a Greenhouse, with Brad Swanson. He was at the helm of that one, and also on Notes for a Novel at Swan Sound Studios. Best recording experience ever. You know, both these two albums, Notes for a Novel and Built Myself a Greenhouse, the synergy, the harmony, the chemistry, everything just came together. I always come into the studio really, really prepared. I work fast, and Chad, you know, worked really, really well too. You know, he was able to find really great people and bring them in and schedule them at the right time. Built Myself a Greenhouse might have been done a month quicker if we'd been able to get certain key players, you know, like Augie Myers out to L.A., you know, a little bit sooner. But no, it takes me about 5 months to do a record.
Here's my Sophie's Choice question for you. What's your favorite song on Notes for a Novel?
Oh, boy. I'm going to have to say... Mars, Don't You Want to Go to Mars? Because, you know, I felt that's a song. By the way, you know, the JPL, JPL is going to use that song to wake up the astronauts.
Awesome.
And one of the reasons they're going to do that is that the fiddle player, the amazing fiddle you hear on that album, is Mark Indictor, who is a scientist on the Mars rover team. But he's also one of the best studio musician violin players in the world. And he, you know, was able to kind of get it in there. The other thing that is great about Mars that makes my favorite cut on the record is working with Janice Ian, of course, and Dean Parks, who listeners might not know who he is, but they know his stuff. Dean Parks is, as Matt Cartsonis would say, one of the interplanetary dudes. He has been around for a long time, over 30 years. He played the guitar on Michael Jackson's Beat It. Not the lead that Eddie Van Halen did, of course, but the that's Dean Parks. He's played on a bunch of records. Haitian Divorce by Steely Dan. Yeah. You know, he came in. He plays the guitar on Unimpressed, too, by the way. That searing lead. That's almost like a whole other. It's a vocal duet almost. Mm-hmm. And that was intentional. That's Dean Parks. That's his guitar chops. But he also plays pedal steel, you know, and he's backed Barbra Streisand at the Oscars. And he did an orchestral processed pedal steel on there that's just out of this world.
Yeah, he's awesome. I know him mostly from Steely Dan, and I really like his style.
Yeah, I could easily listen to Steely Dan 24/7.
Yeah, they're awesome.
There's so many great songs. But in terms of lyrics and meaning and social relevance and the production, I remember when we finished mixing Don't You Want to Go to Mars, Brad Swanson and I did the final mix down. Actually, I would say Chad. Chad's the producer, but the version that we delivered to Chad for him to just fine tune and really, really make it work. I remember looking at Brad, and we said, "Holy mother of, you know, God!" And Brad's not easily hyperbolic, right? He's very level and just a very precise guy. And he says that is the finest produced song that's ever come out of this studio.
That's awesome. That's a huge compliment. Well, Robert, I really appreciate you talking to us tonight, and I wish you a lot of luck with this new CD. It's awesome. It's called Notes for a Novel, and you can get it on CD Baby, or you can go to Facebook and become friends with him on Twitter. And also there's some really nice YouTube videos on there as well that you can see Robert and hear some of his songs and some of his cover versions of some great songs as well.
Exactly.
Is there anything else you wanted to add?
No, I just want to express my appreciation to KC Cafe Radio for getting behind this record and helping me so much. You guys do a great thing, and I'm proud to be on this radio network.
Well, we're proud to have you on as well. Thank you.